we could move ahead by leaps and bounds if the governor would make clear that that veto threat doesn't exist.
The standoff at the state capitol continues. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 19th of April. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the Denali Commission travels the state looking for feedback on its work.
Go back to all the communities where you funded projects and learned what went right and what went wrong. As in, the buck stops here.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Governor Sean Parnell today put more distance between himself and the Senate majority, making it less likely there will be a quick resolution to the impasse that led to the current special session. In a letter to the House and Senate majority and minority leaders that was soon widely distributed throughout the Capitol, the governor put the blame for the special session directly on what he called, quote, the Senate's departure from standard legislative budget practices. He also referred to the Senate's concerns that he will veto capital projects in their districts based on their support of the oil tax cuts that failed to pass this year. However, he took no steps to relieve those concerns. Senate Finance Co-Chairman Bert Stedman said before seeing the letter, he thought talks were going forward toward a resolution, but now he has to wonder if they are further apart.
I think firing off letters like that is like throwing a bomb down the chimney. It's not exactly the way to get things settled down and moving forward, but no matter how big of an explosion it is, you still have to move forward and do the public business.
Referring to the veto threats linked to legislation cutting the tax on oil, Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra said today's letter was not useful.
We could move ahead by leaps and bounds if the governor would make clear that that veto threat doesn't exist, that he will not look particularly at those people who did not support his oil tax legislation. I think that will help us get out of here faster, but I don't think today's letter helped at all.
Stedman says the Office of Management and Budget, as well as the House Finance Committee, has all the documentation necessary for them to review the projects listed in the capital budget. The Denali Commission may have to return $15 million in federal funds. The commission carried over the funds from various sources and obligated them to other projects. Now Congress says it wants the money back. That could have a major impact on projects in rural Alaska. Denali Commission funding reached a high of $140 million from various sources in 2005 and has since been steadily declining. Funding last year was less than $65 million. Amid that reality, commissioners have held listening sessions in Anchorage, Bethel, Fairbanks, and Juneau over the last month. The final session is in Nome tomorrow at Pioneer Hall. Rosemarie Alexander from member station KTOO attended the Southeast Alaska session and files this report.
When the late Senator Ted Stevens wrote the bill creating Denali Commission, he believed an independent federal agency would be more efficient at delivering federal dollars to rural Alaska communities. The commission leverages the money it receives from Congress to attract funding from federal, state, and other partner agencies. It spent more than $1 billion across Alaska over the last 12 years. Most has gone to energy and healthcare projects, the rest to transportation, community facilities, job training, and economic development. At each listening session, commissioners ask Native and community leaders what the commission is doing right, what it should be doing, and how to improve.
Within that environment, I think it's important to note that our funding appropriations each year go down. And so that's an important aspect of our discussions and what we end up doing over the next decade.
The agency is currently going through federal reauthorization. Federal co-chair Joel Niemeyer says the Obama administration's budget indicates strong support, but it's up to Alaska's congressional delegation to convince their colleagues to increase funding.
Federal Office of Management Budget has said very pointedly that they appreciate the work the Denali Commission does in this role of government coordination. They see that as the magic of the commission.
Niemeyer says session comments have generally been focused on energy, health care, and transportation. And while folks have all said thanks, there also is criticism. For example, the tank farm at Gustavus. It's part of the $500 million the commission has spent in Southeast Alaska on energy projects. Mayor Jim Makoviak and predecessor Sandy Marchbank told commissioners at the Juneau session the agency had selected a poor partner for the project, and the community has been dealing with problems ever since.
Please review your policies with the community in mind, not the interpretation of your program partners. Go back to all the communities where you funded projects and learned what went right and what went wrong. The Denali Commission needs to become comfortable in the role of here, as in the buck stops here.
A 2007 McDowell Group report noted similar frustration from other local leaders concerned that goals and priorities of partner agencies, for example, the Alaska Energy Authority, weren't the same as communities. And beyond funding, they didn't know what role the Denali Commission had played in their project. Peter Norrose is general manager and president of Kootsnuwu, Angoon's Village Corporation. He noted money and permission to do things are the biggest obstacles that villages face.
I think being able to streamline and work with the communities and the state and the federal government to come up with recommendations on how we actually build and develop basic infrastructure in rural Alaska is the highest calling of this commission.
Over the last decade, 29% of statewide funding has gone to health care. The agency has been part of building 100 health clinics across rural Alaska. The Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium has received $20 million. Roald Helgeson is president of SEARCH.
And I'm here to also tell you there's 100 more yet to be built. In one of our communities, the community of Hoonah, it's still two 1970s Forest Service trailers tied together by a wanigan. It's in desperate need of renovation.
The Hoonah Clinic is finally on the Denali Commission list and searching for matching funds. Joel Niemeyer has been commissioned federal co-chair for about 15 months. With $1 billion invested in about 2,000 projects statewide, he expects the criticism.
You're going to have some problems here and there, and so if you're trying to shy away from them, then you're not breaking new ground.
Niemeyer says the question becomes, at what funding level can the commission do its job of coordinating federal agencies to deliver the services, programs, and projects that rural Alaska needs?
If you have insufficient funding, then I don't know if you can do it well.
Making comments from the communities even more important. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
The Senate today approved the first steps toward a hydroelectric dam on the Susitna River. The bill, which was included in Governor Parnell's call for a special session, allows the Alaska Energy Authority to start this summer with field studies, taking the first necessary permit and licensing steps to get the project beyond the studies that have already been done. Fairbanks Democrat Joe Thomas said the bill also frees up money for the first work on the site that has been talked about for more than 25 years. And he said people can now stop wondering what would have happened if.
Over these past 25 years, Alaska has missed out on a lot of economic opportunity as well. We've missed the opportunity to create new businesses, new jobs, diversify our economy, because we have not had that low-cost, stable form of power.
The Senate's capital budget provides $65 million this year for work on the project, and lawmakers expect to spend about $30 million a year for the next 5 years. After that, members expect to need as much as $4 billion to finish the project. The bill goes back to the House for a concurring vote before being sent to the governor. Alaska State Troopers are recovering a body off a mountain near Bird Creek between Anchorage and Girdwood. A spokesman for the Alaska Mountain Rescue Group tells the Anchorage Daily News that the man may have died in an avalanche on Bird Ridge. Troopers were summoned when the man didn't show up for work and friends found his car in an area where he liked to hike. The car was found in the parking lot at Bird Creek. Troopers sent a helicopter to search the area, and a spotter saw the body near a mountain. No names have been released. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new documentary tells the story of clergy sex abuse in rural Alaska.
They were robbed of their entire childhood in probably the most egregious and painful way possible in humanity.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com.
The Alaska State Commission for Human Rights has ruled in favor of a Fairbanks woman who claims she was forced from her job by her boss's incessant criticism of her religion. The commission has ordered Goldstream General Store owner Paul Kopf to pay Lynn Dowler over $76,000 in lost wages. Agency attorney Steve Kotev says Kopf used the store as a venue to talk up his Christian faith and make derogatory comments about Catholicism.
Such as Catholics are the root of all evil, or Catholics will burn in hell. These were statements that Lynn Dowler, who is a Catholic, found very offensive, altered the working conditions, if you will, that she found herself in, and ultimately decided that she really couldn't take it anymore and felt that she was forced to quit her job.
Kotev says Dowler's case is somewhat unusual because three fellow former employees backed up her story.
When we prosecute these kinds of cases, we often look for circumstantial evidence to prove the discrimination occurred. Discrimination is a very, very difficult thing to prove in most cases. In this matter, however, we had direct evidence, not just circumstantial, that these actual statements were made.
The Alaska State Commission for Human Rights was established in 1963 to enforce the state's civil rights laws. Its decisions can be appealed in Superior Court, and Kopf, who denies talking down Catholicism, intends to.
They basically charged me that I was the Catholic basher from hell because she had told them that I had told her that Catholics were the root of all evil, which is a fabricated lie.
Kopf says the accusations stem from a broader dispute between him and the former employees. He says Dowler and the three others, including her daughter, became upset and quit because he changed their work hours.
They all wanted me to comply with their desires were. They wanted the shift hours to stay the same. And as somebody had put in, they wanted me not to talk any kind of Christianese. As far as me slamming Catholics, that was all a lie.
Kopf says Dowler and the others are trying to financially ruin him. The Commission for Human Rights ruling in Dowler's favor includes both back and future wages. Dowler worked at the Goldstream store for 27 years prior to quitting in 2009, and the commission's Kotev says she hasn't been able to find a comparable job. A documentary airing on the PBS show Frontline tonight tells the horrific story of clergy sex abuse of children in the village of St. Michael in the 1960s and 70s. Many of the abuse survivors speak publicly for the first time in the film. They hope opening up about their trauma will heal wounds that are still raw 3 decades after the abuse happened. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The documentary is called The Silence, and producer Tom Curran says it's a title that works two ways. The Catholic Church was silent about the abuse that took place in rural Alaska, and so were the victims of that abuse. Curran wasn't sure the victims would want to talk to him, but he says it was a story that haunted him, and so he decided to try.
They just were ready to tell their story and just kind of opened up their hearts and shared a chapter, I think, that was very difficult. So it was definitely a leap of faith, I think, for them. But, I'm just so appreciative that they took that leap.
Many of the victims from St. Michael described daily abuse for years from Father George Endall and a church volunteer named Joseph Lundowski. Curran estimates a staggering 80% of the children in the village were molested from the mid-60s through the mid-70s.
So it was really the whole generation was impacted by this, and not just the people who were abused, which was obviously horrific enough, but their sisters and brothers and moms and uncles and aunts. It's a very close-knit society. It just impacted everybody. And to many degrees still does.
Curran calls St. Michael ground zero for Catholic clergy sex abuse in rural Alaska, but it was by no means unique. Elsie Boudreau was abused over a period of a decade by a priest named Father James Poole in Nome. Boudreau grew up in St. Mary's, but spent summers in Nome. She's now an advocate for other victims and has worked with survivors in many rural villages.
Well, I can tell you generations of people were abused in a number of villages, and St. Michael's is an example of the story that many other people in other villages can share. So it's pervasive. It, you know, from my village alone, 20 men came forward, and I know that's not all of them.
Boudreau went to St. Michael with the filmmakers to listen to stories from the survivors.
After Mass, their parents would start leaving, going home, and Landowski would pull out checkers or chess or card games.
He'd offer us money or drinks or candy or something we want, you know, to do anything to get us at the church.
I was age 12. When he asked me to go in the bedroom with him, I was asking him what for, and he said, I would find out, so I follow him in.
Some of the stories will be with me forever. They were incredibly powerful.
Reporter Mark Trahant says he was reluctant to get involved in the project at first, but the stories grabbed him. He says the victims were robbed of their entire childhood in a horrifying way.
The level of pain, it's really hard to put that in words because it's so deep.
But Trahant says despite that pain, he was surprised at how willing many of the victims were to forgive the Catholic Church. At the end of the film, Fairbanks Bishop Donald Kettler travels to St. Michael to offer a personal apology to the victims. It's a condition of the court settlement.
I've come this evening just to hear what you'd like to tell me or what you'd like to say to me. So if there's something that you'd like to tell me, please, do that.
12 long seconds of silence hang in the air before one of the victims speaks up. The bishop doesn't have any good answers for the questions from survivors that follow, but Elsie Boudreau says just talking about the abuse to church officials or to the film producers is an important step towards healing.
As children, we take ownership of the abuse, and so it, you know, having a film like this would allow for people to begin that discussion and that dialogue and to move that shame from the individuals to where it belongs. And the church needs to own that. The priests need to own that. Because we as survivors did absolutely nothing wrong. What we did was trust them. And they betrayed us.
Producer Tom Curran says 3 decades later, the abuse is still having a strong impact on the community of St. Michael. But he doesn't think it always has to be that way.
The glimmer of hope is that people are starting to talk about it. And I think when you take the mystery away and you take a story that's been in these very long, dark shadows for so long, and you shine light in and you let people hear and feel what's happened, hopefully it starts to lose some of its power and some of its hold on you, and people can start to move forward and heal.
The documentary will be shown on Frontline tonight on PBS stations across Alaska. In Anchorage, it will air on Channel 7 at 8 p.m. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The Beartooth in Anchorage will hold a special screening of the documentary, followed by a panel discussion at 8 p.m. on April 28th.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
The state's redistricting board is taking public comment this week on its two options for an Alaska redistricting map. The first in a series of hearings to be held around the state took place in Anchorage on Monday, and many of the city's residents say the board's draft plan only fractures neighborhoods. Northwest Anchorage resident Shirley Rivas says the draft places half of her Muldoon neighborhood in the Anchorage suburb of Eagle River, some 15 miles away.
I just can't see how we can possibly work together with the Eagle River when, you know, our school districts are so different and our issues are very different. That is basically my concern. Where I live is going to be fractured, and I guess I'm a little upset.
The board released its draft redistricting plan on April 13th, and some said the hearing came before people had a chance to absorb the information. But Dave Ulmer, another Muldoon resident, says the proposed district revision has political overtones.
Big surprise to me, but now I am in an Eagle River Chugiak area, and half of Muldoon's there. That's terrible. I can't imagine what is going through your minds to be doing something like that. It's a horrendous idea. And the only thing I can think of is you guys are trying to do a slice and dice job on Senator Willikowski to bust up his district to get him out of there because he's too much of a thorn in the governor's side.
Both major political parties are watching the redistricting plan unfold with sharp interest. Republican Party of Alaska Chair Randy Redrick said the draft map for Anchorage is troubling at best.
Many of the districts that are created have features that violate the constitutional requirements. Some of the districts are barely contiguous. Others are obviously not compact. The districts ignore local government boundaries.
And Democratic Party of Alaska Executive Director Deborah Williams presented an alternate plan devised by the Rights Coalition. Williams told the panel she was testifying for herself only as a Matsu property owner. Williams said Matsu is required to have five intact house districts based on requirements of 17,775 population as ideal district size.
The state equal protection clause, which guarantees the right to proportional geographic representation. Under option one, the senator for Glacier View would likely come from Ketchikan. That is not going to pass the state constitutional muster. I can absolutely assure you the state Supreme Court will not adopt a plan with non-contiguous pairings of districts.
Williams refers to the option that would create a Southeast Senate district from two House districts separated by hundreds of miles. Perhaps one of the major changes to come will concern the Matanuska-Susitna borough because population growth there will boost representation. The redistricting board holds hearings this week in Fairbanks, Juneau, and Cordova. The capital budget, up for debate during this week's special session, includes money to help Ketchikan's shipyard get ready to build the first Alaska-class ferry. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Doug Ward looks out of his Ketchikan office window and sees a lot of ferries.
We've got the Columbia on dry dock number one. Fairweather is at South Berth. The Chenega is on dry dock number two. And then we've got a commercial barge on berth one.
And that's not all for Ward's Alaska Ship and Dry Dock. It's built a ferry that will link Anchorage and the Matanuska-Susitna borough, plus a short-hop Ketchikan Airport shuttle ship. The facility also hopes to get the contract for the Marine Highway System's new Alaska-class ferries. They're the ships designed to mostly travel day routes, such as Juneau to Haines or Ketchikan to Prince Rupert.
We've got a lot of work going on here and are looking forward to having a lot work in the next few years building Alaska's marine products.
The shipyard's prospects could get even better if money for continued improvements remains in the legislature's capital projects budget and escapes the governor's veto pen. The Senate's version includes $6 million for the facility, and that's the measure lawmakers are considering during the special session. The money would help complete a $30 million-plus enclosed construction and repair building. Ward says that's where the new ferries would be put together.
Just being enclosed improves quality and scheduling and reduces the costs of building ships, as well as repairing them.
Key lawmakers, including Sitka Senator and Finance Committee Co-Chairman Bert Stedman, would like to see the new ferries be built at the shipyard. The desire for an in-state preference, plus environmental requirements, led officials to drop $60 million in federal funds needed to get the first new ferry built. Stedman came up with a plan to direct that money to highway projects up north. In return, $60 million in state general funds would go into an account used to build new ships. That money was first put in other spending bills.
We've got some of those monies in the operating budget, and we're working that through the system.
That will be in addition to $60 million already put aside. Ferry System Chief Mike Neusel says the total could cover its cost.
I emphasize the word estimate because we have not actually gone on contract with anybody to actually build the Alaska-class ferry, so we don't actually know what it will cost. But the best estimate for the ship is $120 million.
He also stresses that the ferry system has not committed to building at any particular location. But Ketchikan Representative Kyle Johansson says the intent is clear.
We've proven we can build any vessel that the designers can come up with, and building that Alaska-class ferry would be challenging, but we've proven we can do it. So it's just a matter of getting the third floor to the governor to commit to it.
The capital budget also includes $3.4 million to help the Marine Highway move some waterfront facilities away from Alaska Ship and Dry Dock. That's giving the shipyard more room to grow. Neusel says the move includes a warehouse and a backup berth.
There is funding in this bill to actually move the dock where we do dockside maintenance layups and actually handle overflow traffic loading and unloading ships when the Ketchikan main ferry terminal is occupied and we have two ships in at once, to actually relocate functionally that capability out to Ward Cove.
That's a few miles to the north where ferry headquarters are located. The capital budget also includes money for a variety of vessel maintenance and upkeep projects. The biggest is $25 million for the Columbia, the fleet's largest vessel.
The engines on there are worn and old, and we would like to not see an unplanned breakdown, catastrophic failure of those engines.
The budget also includes money to upgrade Pelican's ferry terminal and to survey the condition of the fleet. Disagreements over the capital budget helped send lawmakers into special session, so many of its projects may undergo scrutiny. But ferry and shipyard supporter Stedman oversees the bill, so chances are good those projects will remain in play. Ferry repair projects also use federal money, which is usually less controversial. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Rosemarie Alexander, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com. One answer to our state's declining oil production? Port McKenzie Rail Project. The link from the Alaska Railroad to a deepwater port will bring billions in mineral production and thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska Susitna Borough.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.